I was raised the first 10 years of my life on a small farm outside Melbourne with a floral emphasis. And my grandfather used to grow chrysanthemums for the Mother's Day market. The last 25 years, I've lived on a farm in the upper Hunter of New South Wales, where we've tried to garden furiously, but a decade of drought put an end to that. But I still think of myself and often describe myself as chlorophyllic. So you can imagine my astonishment when I learned that there is, in fact, a condition known as chlorophyllia. And I'm going to ask my next guest about it because he knows everything there is to know about gardens. And he sees them as more than a place for conversation or pottering or meandering, daydreaming, reflecting. He writes that the gardens that have graced this mortal Eden of ours are the best evidence for humanity's reason for being on Earth. Robert Pogue Harrison is a professor of Italian literature at Stanford, and his book is called Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition. And Robert joins me now from Palo Alto in California. And Robert, I believe you have a G&T awaiting you.
I have a G&T awaiting me once this conversation is over, Phil, so that I don't compromise my lucidity.
No, feel free to sip. Look, welcome. Before we get stuck into the book, tell me about chlorophyllia. Is it a medical condition or a desirable state?
To tell you the truth, I coined that term myself.
Ah, you made it up.
To tell you, yes. There is another term that exists called biophilia, which encompasses the love of all living things. That would include plants as well as animals, I suppose. That was made famous, that term, by Edward Wilson. But I chose the term chlorophyllia to describe something a little bit more specific, which is our love of and need for green things around us.
My partner is chlorophyllic. She's not more expansive than that, because when she's in gardening mode, she hates all animals, the rabbits that the sheep that try and get in and eat the damn thing, you know, the plants. Anyway, that's not dawdle. You're a literature professor, Robert, and you've looked at how we've written about gardens throughout the history of Western imagination. How come a literature professor has leaped into this form of horticulture?
Two possible answers to that question. First, gardens punctuate the history of literature from the very first literary work that has come down to us in all of history, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh from the Sumerians, Babylonians, which describe two gardens, actually, earthly paradises where there's no mortality, where it's always spring weather, and where Gilgamesh, the hero of the epic, desperately tries to achieve his own immortality, only to be told that he has to go back to his earthly city of Uruk, that he will not be able to enjoy this earthly paradise. He must be mortal. And there's another one called the Garden of the Sun. So that's already in the first epic.
And they precede that tired old story about the Garden of Eden then.
Exactly. The Garden of Eden is very similar to that garden in Gilgamesh. There's also gardens in Homer, the island of Calypso, where Odysseus is stuck for a while, for many years actually. It's very much of an earthly paradise. She even offers Odysseus immortality to stay with him there. And it's true that the earthly paradise is a very ancient, pervasive myth in human cultures.
Now, tell us about Eden. What went wrong there? You talk about it, you know, as having no death, not yet birth, no labor, not yet responsibility.
Well, indeed, I read the story of Eden as a story of a liberation rather than the story of a fall from grace, because it seems that God, when he created Adam, wanted to protect his newborn from what we would today called reality. Therefore, the Garden of Eden was a place that was enclosed. It was tame, safe. Everything was provided for Adam without labor, without the need for investment on his part, labor on his part. Even his wife was provided for him.
You describe her as a Stepford wife of sorts.
Well, Eve was a Stepford wife of sorts. that's what all that was required of her was to just sort of play a part along there without any particular subjectivity, and certainly with no expectation of self-realization. And I claim that Eve, who has gotten the blame for two millennia for our human condition, should also get the credit for having freed us from that infantilizing environment of Eden.
Hence you dedicate the book to Eve and her daughters.
I do.
That's very sweet, Robert. That's very sweet. Let's now leap a couple of millennia on to the point of the political connection between what we call the moral oblivion of Eden and contemporary capitalism.
Yes, that's quite a leap. However, this connection is substantial in my mind because I believe that the world that we inhabit in the first world these days, the hyper-capitalist economy, combined with modern contemporary technology, is trying to recreate an Edenic world for us where the citizen has no other obligation than to consume the fruits of the earth in a passive sort of receptive mode without giving back either his or her labor and blood, sweat, and tears. And more we expect things to be given to us freely.
So once again, we're infantile.
Well, we risk becoming infantilized by a consumerist society which does not have as part of its equation what I think is the true source of human happiness, or at least human self-realization, which is cultivation.
Mm.
And there's a difference, stark alternatives of cultivation and consumption, I think, are two alternatives that face us today, and point out that's why I think it's so important to revisit the old stories of the earthly paradise in order to realize that we were not made to inhabit earthly paradises, that we were never happy there in the first place, and therefore this drive that seems to be motivating the contemporary economy as well as technology to recreate an Edenic condition is not one that is really fostering happiness.
Well, from the first cataract down the Nile, of course, you have a long filament of garden, as opposed to the Deshert, as it was known,
yes,
on either side. Intense cultivation and a great aesthetic. But I'm not sure about the Greeks. They didn't have suburban gardens, did they?
No. In fact, it seems that there were no gardens inside of the walls of Athens. However, there are gardens in Homer, obviously, and outside of the walls of Athens, there were properties, many of them garden-like properties. And the ones that I focus on in the ancient world, the Greek world, are especially the great schools of philosophy, which for some reason all seem to take place in these garden-like environments. Plato founded his academy outside the walls of Athens in a park. It was a municipal park, but nevertheless enclosed and verdant.
That is a word I don't think anyone's ever used on this program in over 20 years. Verdant, I like that.
Epicurus, and we tend to forget that Epicureanism was one of the most successful philosophies ever in the history of Western culture. It lasted for 7 centuries as a dominant philosophy. It all began in a garden, a private garden owned by Epicurus. In fact, his school was called the Garden School because the disciples actually cultivated in a literal sense what we would today call a kitchen garden with fruits and vegetables. But they did it not only to eat the results of their labor, but also to learn the lessons of nature and to learn the cycles of the seasons and the get into attunement with the cosmos through this gardening activity. And then there are several other schools which are also marginal to the center of the city, the radioactive center of the agora, where education seems to find its natural habitat for some reason in these garden-like environments.
There's some continuation of that tradition in many universities. I remember visiting Stanford decades ago, and it was quite pleasantly arboreal at the time, and most Australian universities used to make an attempt to plant a few trees. In fact, I go back to what you were saying about your relationship with your students with a quote from Plato. The highest happiness a human being can attain comes from nourishing new life in the soul of a student. The teacher plants seeds in a student's soul, which in turn will produce new seeds to be planted in other students' souls. Is the 21st century student, does he or she want to have the seeds planted in them?
It depends on the student, and that sounds like an evasion, but it's crucial to Plato's own conception of education. Plato believed that the vast majority of potential students did not have in their minds a kind of soil that was hospitable to the cultivation of philosophy and of ideas. Therefore, the first responsibility of the teacher is to choose properly in which soil he is going to sow his seeds. That means to choose his students very carefully. Hence, the Platonic Academy was a highly selective, elitist kind of
aspiring to, quote, the highest happiness.
The highest happiness, yes, exactly. And Plato believed that this process of education, of sowing seeds, nurturing the growth in the student's mind, seeing a student finally understand the essence of truth, the essence of beauty, and of the higher ideas, that there was no greater satisfaction than that.
LNL on Radio National Summer, and you're listening to Robert Pogue Harrison, author of a verdant book called Gardens, an essay on the human condition. Would you be kind enough to tell your Australian listeners, all of whom are frenzied gardeners, I suspect, about the Cura fable about the creation of mankind, the role of care?
Yes, which goes back to what I said earlier about the way human beings are not at home in earthly paradises. There's an old ancient fable about the goddess Cura, care, who was walking by a river one day, took up some clay and made a man, and then asked Jupiter to breathe life into this creature, this thing that she had produced. Jupiter did that, and it became the first human being. Then they had a dispute over what its name should be, and the Earth, Saturn was called settled the dispute and said that upon this creature's death, its spirit shall be handed over to Jupiter because he breathed life into it, and his life, it will go back to Jupiter. Cura, who formed the creature, shall have possession of this man for as long as he lives. And as to his name, he shall be called Homo, because he was made of the humus, of the soil. And this myth affirms, among other things, that as long as we are alive as human beings, we are in the tenacious embrace of the goddess Cura, and that care is really our primary vocation. That means in both senses that we are burdened with cares, and at the same time we are also called upon to be caretakers of things that which are not ourselves.
So care, in this sense, is the secret of human happiness.
I believe that if any kind of happiness that does not involve a dominant role for care is not possible for us. And that the danger of this society that we are talking about, the consumer society, is that it thinks that it can dispense with care as an essential ingredient to human happiness.
Voltaire, and you quote him, said, "We must cultivate our garden, we must tend to our own affairs." And I'm charmed by the sudden memory that Einstein was a gardener right to the end. He loved pottering around with his pot plants at the uni.
Yes, that's quite interesting. What Voltaire, his dictum, famous final dictum there in his novel Candide, it's interesting that he uses the plural, "We must cultivate our garden." And Einstein was cultivating his own personal garden as a private gardener. But I think what Voltaire was getting at was the need to cultivate not only our literal gardens, but whatever community brings us together as a collective.
Robert, I suspect that Einstein was very much a cosmic gardener, that he saw great metaphors in the earth and these little plants.
He would have been very much at home in a Zen garden, I suppose, because Zen gardens are precisely designed in order to give one a direct sort of intuition of cosmic reality.
Yes, talk to the Zen garden briefly. They seem to me quite anomalous.
Well, they are anomalous insofar as they are not chlorophyliac per se, as we were mentioning earlier. They are made of sand and stones, disposed in such a way as to allow the eye, which lingers on the elements that constitute the Zen garden, to divagate with its own internal imagination and to see the rocks as boulders and to then see those boulders as mountains, to see the sand as oceans, and even within the small space of a Zen garden, to come to a realization that one is a complete part of the cosmos as a whole.
I tell you something, Robert, 10 years trying to do a farm garden during intense drought produces a Zen garden without human effort.
Yes.
But it wasn't so deeply philosophical, I've got to say. Your specialty, as I've said, is Italian literature, and you spend some time in the book discussing a false garden in an Italian romance novel from the 16th century. Share your fascination with it.
Yes, in Ariosto's epic called the Orlando Furioso, there's one of these typical enchanted gardens of Renaissance literature on the island of Alcina, who is a sorceress. And there she lures knights into her garden with false appearances. Actually, all the fauna, all the flora and plants are her previous lovers who have been transformed into the plants. So it's a garden of illusion, of deception, of feminine sorcery, and it exercises a fascination on these knights even after they've been liberated from its prison. And I find that it serves almost as an allegory for large segments of our own contemporary entertainment culture, where we tend to get mesmerized by illusion and bewitched by promises of fantastical adventures and happiness, which, of course, are not quite based in reality.
Not to mention the most alchemical claims by cosmetic manufacturers and their commercials.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Tell us about the Dante's Inferno. Do you stumble across the odd garden there?
Well, actually, the Inferno is the prelude to getting back to the Garden of Eden. In fact, the Inferno begins in a dark forest. It's a dark, wild place. It's the anti-garden, if you like, because it is not cultivated, it's not tame, and it's not under the jurisdiction of the human governance. So from the dark wood, Dante has to descend through the nine circles of hell, emerge at the foot of the mountain of purgatory, and then climb the terraces of purgatory in order to arrive finally in the Garden of Eden that has been now recovered in its innocence. So in a certain sense, that whole journey through hell and purgatory is in order to be able for the first time to find himself in the Garden of Eden. Now, how long does Dante spend in the Garden of Eden? He doesn't spend more than a few hours before he goes on to paradise. This, for me, is another strange confirmation of the fact that he is not very... there's nothing in the Garden of Eden that really lures him to it. And when you go to paradise, now he's in the realm of ecstasy, rapture, and transcendence. There was something too even-tempered. There was something too serene about Eden. And one thing I think we have to confess to ourselves as Westerners is that we are not very comfortable with serenity.
Now, this is a point you make, that some of Islam's hostility to Western modernity may have to do with the way the Bible begins with the exile, in your view, a fortunate one from Eden, whereas the Quran imagines the paradise of death as a return to Eden.
In fact, I think it's a very big divide between the Quran and certainly the Christian scriptures, that in the Christian tradition, heaven is conceived of as a celestial paradise. In the Quran, it is an earthly paradise. And when one reads all those long, elaborate descriptions of paradise in the Quran, one finds that they are places of, that the Garden of Eden is a, and it's called the Garden of Eden, it's a place of repose, the fruits are hanging generously over the couch on which one reclines, the water's flowing, very much like all the traditional descriptions of earthly paradises. Western sensibility, and Dante, I think, confirms this, is not particularly drawn to that notion of heaven. Our Judeo-Christian, or let's say our Christian vision of heaven, is really one much more about rapture and transcendence and ecstasy.
One of the reasons the French aristocracy had their heads pruned, in my view, is because they had over-pruned gardens. You and I share a deep dislike of Versailles.
Yes. Good, I'm glad to hear that.
Oh, I can't bear the place.
I can't either. In fact, after a day or two there, the oppression is almost as political as you can imagine.
Because off with their heads, I say.
Yeah, well, in fact, it's a monarchical garden in the worst sense, where everything is subjugated to the law of the monarch. Everything is dominated by a centralized perspective, and it militates against the freedom of wandering and the freedom of one's own imagination.
In contrast to the great English gardens that were illusions of nature, where art was concealed quite skillfully, and the gardens grew more and more, well, natural.
Well, certainly they were made to look as if they were completely natural, and there was not this heavy-handed control over the artifice of the garden. The artifice was more concealed. Now, that doesn't mean that there was not a great deal of artifice that went into their making. It's just that they were much more hospitable to what we would call a romantic spirit, which worships the law of nature over the law of artifice. And in fact, one of the first things that Romanticism accomplished was a change in the aesthetics of gardens in Europe.
There's a lovely story in the book. In fact, there's a photograph about the gardens created by homeless people in New York. Tell the listener about Jimmy's garden.
Well, Jimmy's garden is one of these homeless gardens in the ghettos of New York, where these people would put together found objects, old tires, toys, teddy bears, maybe some leaves, and put them together in these sort of synthetic constructions that one has no choice but to call gardens, really, even though they might not be a place where plants grow in any way. And there's a picture of this guy, Joe, who has created his own little thing, and he's sitting there in a chair.
And he's looking very proud, isn't he?
He's looking very proud, and if you, unfortunately, our listeners can't see the image in their minds, they would have to get the book. But
they will, don't worry. They'll rush out after this while you're having your G&T. They'll be off to the
bookshop. When they do see the picture, they'll see that he has created lines of orientation, and this is one of the basic human needs that gardens also answer to. That in a formless, inarticulate environment, as in some of these urban wastelands where these homeless gardens appear, there is a need for creating limitations and orientation, a place a sanctuary of repose in the midst of all this turbulent frenzy.
Some people try to get that feeling out of a goldfish bowl, or as I said, out of a couple of pot plants on the 40th floor of a building of condos, don't they? But you don't need that much to trigger this response you're describing.
The difference, however, Philip, is that the you cannot inhabit a fishbowl or a little pot of plants on a balcony, whereas gardens, in the truest sense, are places that you can actually be inside of.
Yeah.
And even
point taken. Why is it? I don't know if you've noticed this, but around the world, people are often provided with quite generous municipal gardens of various degrees of pleasantness. And it always amazes me that despite the density of the surrounding population, there's very rarely many people in the damn things.
Perhaps that has something to do with the fact that a garden is most satisfying when one has put one's own authorship into its creation.
Good point. Good point, yeah. But, you know, one of the things about America which astonishes me is that Central Park, probably, arguably, amongst the world's most expensive pieces of real estate, has survived in hyper-capitalist America. You would have think it would have been subdivided a century ago.
Well, that's because Central Park is completely crucial to the psychic health of most New Yorkers, and the authorities are aware of that. It is the pride and joy of that city. First thing, it was very beautifully designed and conceived, and it keeps that city marginally sane. The city is insane anyway, but without Central Park, I think people realize that New York would totter on the edge of the abyss.
Robert, I always conduct this program with my own pet pot plant sitting beside me on the panel here. It's a rhododendron. Would you like to say goodnight to it?
Yes, I would. What color is it?
Oh, no, you've got me. It's not flowering at the moment. Robert, you are, though. You flowered very nicely then. You now deserve your G&T. That was Robert Pogue Harrison. He's Professor of Italian Literature at Stanford University. His book is called Gardens, an Essay on the Human Condition, published by Chicago University Press. And on our next, it's a full-length interview I recorded with Australian composer Peter Sculthorpe, who turned 80 this year. Good on you, Pete.